people are going to start shorting the market again, because there's a lot of people who have either been perma bears for 15 years, or they've been perma bears for 5 years, or they just cannot accept that equities are going higher. And many people want this market to go lower.
Based on prevailing sentiment of the market, banks, and popular culture, yes, it's a foolish investment, but everyone's wrong.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. Brent, it's been maybe the week we've been waiting for some time. It was action-packed. There was a lot that unfolded, a lot, not only in terms of the data sets that came out, but potentially giving us some sense of where we're headed in inflation metrics, Fed policy, and maybe in, as far as what many feel has been a blow off top or just, you know, irrational exuberance. Maybe we should start with some of that irrationality in markets we've seen pretty much since last year, and perhaps the pullback that we've seen in some of that, speaking of NVIDIA specifically. Is that a good place for you to start?
Sure, yeah. You know, last week had the potential to be like a very pivotal week. It kind of turned it out to not be necessarily, because everything just kind of remained at its all-time high. Gold went to an all-time high. Bitcoin went to an all-time high. Equities were already kind of there, but, you know, they kind of stayed there but went a little bit higher. But we, you know, we had a couple different, you know, economic indicators that came out. We had a big one in non-farm payrolls. Powell testified for 2 days in front of the Congress. So you had the potential for a lot of stuff to happen. But really what happened is everything just kind of ran up to its high and then stayed there. The one potential thing that's going to be very interesting for next week is you know, halfway through the day on Friday, you know, non-farm payrolls came out. Everything went higher, but and NVIDIA jumped up. You know, I think we said, I don't remember if it was last week or 2 weeks ago. Wait, I said in the month of March, NVIDIA would probably hit both 1,000 and 500. Well, it went to 972 on Friday morning, and then, you know, kind of midday, it turned over and it sold off, and it ended at 872. Now, here's the funny thing: 872 is still $50 higher than it was the Friday before. But it's $100 higher than $100 lower than it was 4 hours before. And so it'll be interesting to see which way NVIDIA goes on Monday, because, you know, the funny thing is I'm really not a single stock guy, but NVIDIA is kind of macro now, because NVIDIA and these, you know, beautiful seven or magnificent seven, I don't even remember what the right name is anymore. It has such an influence on the overall market that even if you do macro, the big picture stuff, you kind of have to pay attention to NVIDIA, which is silly, but hey, this is the world we live in. So it was a very interesting week. And now I kind of feel like next week's to be even more interesting, because, you know, again, everything went to its all-time high last week, and now we got to see whether that continues or whether we get some kind of a pause.
Yeah, look, the I guess there's really not much to unpack specifically, because everything is just bouncing off of these all-time highs. NVIDIA is probably the poster child for both the potential of a pullback and or whether or not, you know, this is the rally is just beginning. But one of the things that you've mentioned is probably worth having you address again is this idea. And even for me, when I'm looking at this frothiness, it's great that, you know, markets have just slowly climbed the mountain to these all-time highs, but it doesn't feel like there's anything left and the rocket boosters to push beyond this. And this has been kind of one of your points, is that you're not calling for the end of the world, but you do feel like a sell-off is necessary if we're going to have a healthy surge into new all-time highs.
Yeah, and so I still feel that way. Again, I feel like we need to have some kind of a pullback in order to, you know, provide the juice. Because here's the thing, if we start to get a pullback, people are going to start shorting the market again, because there's a lot of people who have either been perma bears for 15 years, or they've been perma bears for 5 years, or they just cannot accept that equities are going higher. And many people want this market to go lower. So if we do start to get some kind of a pullback, people are going to try to short it, and the short interest could rise very quickly. Like right now, everybody's long, right? And so when you get to a point where everybody's long, you don't really need a catalyst to go lower. You just need new people to stop showing up. And if everybody's already long, there's no new people to come in. So the point is, if we do start to get a sell-off, people are going to try to short it. And I think they could start trying to short it pretty quickly and pretty heavily. And then they become the fuel that could then allow us to go to really all-time highs, which is ultimately where I think we get to 2 or 3 years from now. But I do think that it's more likely than not that we're still going to get some kind of a pullback here in the near term. But here's the thing, and I've talked about this before. My friend Todd and I talk every week, and Todd's the best money manager I know. Guy never loses money. And it doesn't mean he always gets things wrong, or it doesn't mean he always gets things right. It's just that when he gets things wrong, they're small, and he's just very consistent about consistently making money. And his point is, listen, it doesn't really matter if the Fed cuts 2 times this year or if they cut 12 times this year. The point is they're going to cut. And if things stay healthy, which they kind of are, and the Fed cuts, that is a tailwind for equities. So as long as the market knows that cuts are coming, that's enough to keep the animal spirits going. And you know what? He's been saying this for about 6 months and he's been right. So, you know, we can sit here and we can talk about why this should happen or why that should happen. But the reality is the market's at all-time highs, and the people who've called for it were to go to all-time highs, they are right. The people who have called for a pullback or a sell-off or a crash, they've been wrong. You know, we can philosophize of why this is, and we can say it's not fair, and we can say it shouldn't happen. But at the end of the day, you know, price is what matters, and price is where it's at. Now, having said that, I'm going to keep saying the thing I've said. I think it makes sense to have equities here, but you can't just be, I don't think you can be long equities without having some kind of either cash on the sidelines waiting for the pullback or some kind of hedges against your equities. You know, because I do think that things have just, you know, from a sentiment perspective, from a positioning perspective, I think they're offsides. So I remain watchful for a pullback that I think will come, but I'm the first to admit that I could be wrong and this thing could keep going higher. I do think that Friday was a very interesting day because, you know, markets tried to go higher on the non-farm payrolls, and by the end of the day, they were lower. So I think, you know, this week we've got CPI coming up. Obviously, it's going to be, again, the most important CPI in history. The following week, we've got the Fed meeting. And so, you know, we'll see where we're at in a couple of weeks.
So another thing too here, as far as the idea that we need this fuel to push higher, is also the idea you don't have a bottom until, you know, everyone has sold, and you don't have a top until everyone has bought. There still is this, it feels like, intense stubbornness from the bears that, you know, this is all but 1 second away from a major crash. Now, currently you have some work going on at your home there in Puerto Rico. And so there's a bit of office furniture relocation. You're, you know, borrowing a chair for this recording, which is more of a gaming chair. It kind of makes you look like Emperor Palpatine, Star Wars Emperor. You got the hood vibe going.
So yeah, it's my son's gaming chair. Just so we're clear, you know, I have not become the Emperor. I have not joined the Sith. A lot of people think I'm already on the dark side because, you know, I think the dollar is going higher, but this is there's no innuendo here. This isn't some subtle thing. it's the growing pains of remodeling an apartment.
Well, look, speaking of the dark side, where I was kind of headed with that is the darkest of the dark for many of us is the central bankers of the world. And, you know, as far as sentiment goes and the things that are driving this market higher, we did have, you know, some fuel to add to this idea that eventually the Fed's going to cut because of the conversation and testimony that Powell provided, which was relatively, you know, dovish in a lot of ways, which I wouldn't say is a surprise, but given the difficulty that they've had in really convincing the market that they're playing tough, it feels like, you know, that was a kind of a surprise in terms of his tone.
Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty clear. It became pretty clear, you know, at some point last year that Powell wants to cut. You know, they feel they, again, whether you agree with this or not, that's a separate issue. They feel like they now have inflation under control. It's not, you know, where they want it to be, but it's also not rocketing higher the way it was a year and a half, 2 years ago. And they feel like they have it on a good glide path lower. They feel like they will get to their 2% objective. And what they don't want to do is cause the hard landing. I think when they started off, they probably expected a hard landing, but now they feel like they don't have to cause the hard landing. And so they've got this glide path towards 2%. And as a result, what they don't want to do is overshoot and have a crash.
Right.
And so, you know, it's pretty clear to me that they want to cut, because they feel like if they keep rates where they're at now, that it will be too tight as inflation starts to fall. The question I have is whether or not the market lets them cut to the rate or the speed with which the market is pricing in. And what I mean by that is the market is pricing in all of these cuts. The question becomes is, as the data continues to come out, will the data allow them to cut at the rates that the market expects? And will it even allow them to cut at the speed that Powell wishes? Because again, the market's pricing in a different speed than Powell is talking about, right? And it could be that inflation, for whatever reason, whether it's geopolitical, whether it's supply chain related, whether it's structural, it could be that inflation still doesn't rocket higher, but maybe it just doesn't continue to fall. Maybe it just plateaus here for 6 months. Again, you know, everybody likes to say that they know what's going to happen, but the reality is nobody knows what's going to happen. And I continue to believe that while Powell wants to cut, I don't think it's going to be as easy for him to cut. I don't think the data is going to be as easy for him to cut as the market's pricing in. And if he does have to cut, it will be because I think deflationary forces will be overtaking it, and he will be trying to resolve some kind of a mini crisis as opposed to just going towards his soft landing.
Okay, well, look, let's look at it from the standpoint of where we've been to where we've come. The Fed has had everything play out ideally. If they had charted a roadmap, which would have been ideal for them, they're pretty much there, except for the front running of markets and the animal spirits, basically pushing prices to where they think the Fed ultimately is going to accommodate. And again, you've said many times, we talk about on the show frequently, that markets run on expectations. So the expectation maybe is exactly where, you know, all of this is already priced in. But here's my question for you. If the banking sector, which we haven't really talked about a lot, and it's probably something we should touch on here, if the credit markets and the banking sector wasn't getting choked out in a lot of ways, why would they cut? Wouldn't it be fine for them just to kind of coast sideways, because the equity markets are kind of doing the job for them to kind of keep that soft landing as part of the narrative? The only thing that's really starting to get shaky in the background is commercial real estate and ultimately, you know, the regional banks and commercial banks.
Well, I think that is what you're touching on in my mind is probably why the Fed wants to cut. Again, I think the Fed wants to cut. I think they want to get monetary policy a little bit easier, because I think that they either think or they know that perhaps the banking system is not quite as sound as they want people to think it is, right? And we, you know, we continue to have these anecdotal things show up. You know, we had, I can't remember the name, Community Bank Corp in New York or something, had to get a huge injection this week. We continue to see, you know, things in the commercial real estate sector where you get these anecdotal things where a building sold for, you know, 10 cents on the dollar or whatever it is. And if and when these banks have to start marking their books to market, it's going to cause, you know, all kinds of problems. And I think the Fed knows this, right? And so I think the Fed kind of wants to get in front of that a little bit, or at least be prepared to respond to that. But here's the problem is we've got a number of different things that are going to happen, and they're going to happen over the next 6 to 8 months. So you got to remember, we got an election in November, right? And Biden apparently, I haven't heard it yet, but I read an article where he was giving a speech yesterday and said something about, you know, those guys that said interest rates, well, don't worry, they're coming down, something to that effect. So again, I don't know if he's trying to pressure the Fed to do it. I don't know if he's had conversations with the Fed. I don't know if he's just wanting this to kind of continue the market booming into the election. But regardless, here's the different dynamics we have. Is on the one hand, they probably want the Fed to cut, or at least continue their moving towards an easier monetary policy in order to support asset prices heading into the election. The last thing they want is to have a big crisis where assets are plummeting leading up to an election. That's exactly what happened in 2008, if you remember, you know, when McCain and Obama were running, you know, we were dealing with a global financial crisis literally in the middle of the campaign. That's the last thing that Biden wants to be dealing with heading into November. The problem is that in order to get these cuts to come, you know, you've got to have inflation falling. But if you start cutting, then you have the potential to spur inflation higher, right? So if they cut too soon, then it's potentially inflation's going to flare back up going into the election. And, you know, the Republicans could use that against Biden. Or if they don't cut enough, then you could have all these problems start to show up in August, September, October, and you start to... So this glide path that the Fed is on, I mean, it is... This it is really important for them to stick this landing, right? And for it to be a smooth one. So, and again, I'm not saying it can't be smooth. I'm just saying there is a lot of factors that can very easily make it not go smooth. Not even considering all the social factors that are going to start to heat up as we head towards the presidential election. I don't know if you happen to watch the State of the Union address. I watched about half of it. And what struck me was that there was no effort at all on the behalf of Biden to try to unify. There was no effort at all to try to reach over the aisle. There was no effort at all to say, hey, at the end of the day, we're all Americans. He basically got up, at least for the first half that I watched, he basically got up there and yelled at half the country. You know, and it kind of reminded me, here's the funny thing, it kind of reminded me of Trump's inaugural speech. When Trump was inaugurated, you know, many pundits, many people said it was the darkest, quote unquote, inaugural speech a president has ever given, because he kind of blamed the other side and he kind of railed and he was kind of mad. And people just said in general, it wasn't a happy and upbeat inauguration. It was kind of a more negative inauguration. And that's really how I felt about Biden's speech. It was very kind of condescending. It was very dark. It was very, he was angry. He was like an angry old man yelling at the clouds. And I just thought, you know, here we are, we're heading, the country's as divided as it's been as long as I've been alive. You know, we already know it's going to be a very contentious election. And, you know, heading into, you know, November, I think socially it's just going to get even crazier. And in my eyes, at least, Biden did absolutely nothing to alleviate that stress. And if anything, he kind of kicked the hornet's nest even more.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at surveys and statistics and the various polls, it's not going well for him. So I think the at this point, the most viable campaign strategy is to really, like you said, rally or kick that hornet's nest. I'll admit I didn't waste a single second of my time on that speech, because politics at this point has gotten more about like this internal fraternity fight than anyone. Yeah. Not that any one of these people really cared before, but it's gotten so like disconnected from what the average person is really struggling with and feeling with. That's what frustrates me the most. Is like, you know, you throw these daggers at each other, but neither one of you are really listening to the pain point. And, you know, that it's a good pivot into talking a little bit more about the non-farm payroll employment data, because, man, I just feel like there's certainly a crop of people that get all of their reality and all their news from Fox and all of their reality and all their news from the left, whether it's MSNBC or whatever it happens to be. And I think that's a very extreme set of sides. I think most of the country, and this is merely my perspective, but I feel like people are more centered and moderate. Yep. And have common sense. And you can look at things that are going on, and you can look at the data. And if anyone is engaged in financial markets, and you understand that probably the two biggest data sets that anyone pays attention to on a monthly basis is non-farm payroll and CPI. No one's going to sit here and think that in July 2022, inflation was 9%. It was 19% at least. And no one's going to sit here and think that, you know, we added almost 400,000 jobs last month and another almost 300,000 this month. Meanwhile, you had these huge revisions to last month, which brought it down, you know, within within expectations. So there's now you have a gamification of the data because no one's really looking backwards to see the adjustments. But in this particular non-farm payroll, yeah, the headline number, you know, people at this point, the core data was so weak that we just look past the headline. And I think those elements I'd like to get your thoughts on, in particular, the revision, the fact that unemployment jumped. And then most importantly, I think in context of all of this, is that you, number one, had a downgrade in wage, in the wages, which is really an inflation metric amongst all of it. Yep. But then when you look at the actual jobs, everything is basically a foreign born new job at it. Is that because of the open borders or something else that's been going on that's actual legal migration is a whole other conversation. But you're also seeing, when you look at the household survey, which is more hard data, you're seeing a decline in full-time jobs. So almost everything that's being added to that non-farm payroll headline number is part-time. So it's getting to the point where the Fed might not be, you know, smudging data or leaning one side to the other when it comes to policy, but clearly the Bureau of Labor Statistics is.
Yeah. So, this is what makes last week, even though it was for the most part rather calm and everything kind of bubbled to its highs, all-time highs, what happened with non-farm payrolls, and then what happened the rest of the day in asset prices. That makes it pretty interesting. Next week's going to be, I know I say this word interesting all the time, but I'm one of those guys who on Saturday night, I can't wait for the market to open on Monday because I really want to see what's going to happen. And a lot of it goes back to the non-farm payrolls and the revisions that you're talking about. Again, the headline came out, and I think the expectations were for 200,000 jobs, and the number came out as 275. Now, normally, that would be seen as the market's doing fantastic. That's hawkish. There's no reason for the Fed to cut. And so that would tend to be negative for risk assets because of where we're at in the cycle. But what happened was, even though you had this huge beat, wages came in lower, as you said, which means that's a big inflation gauge. So that takes a little bit away. But then also the unemployment rate went up. So that's a little bit negative, right? That tends to say that the economy is slowing down a little bit. So that leans towards a dovish Fed. But to me, the big one was the revisions, because it wasn't a small revision. I don't remember what the number was exactly, but it went from a huge beat. I mean, it was revised like 25 or 30%. It was a huge revision. And so it's not just that one revision. There's been many revisions here today. That one was the biggest one. But what it immediately does is, if it had been revised down like 10 or 20,000, okay, that kind of makes sense. But when it's revised down like 80,000 or 100,000 or whatever it was, that's a huge revision. So then that throws into question the current number, right? Because if the current number says it's 275, well, that means it could easily be 175, right? So now you stop trusting the current number. And you start looking at the secondary data. And the secondary data was much more dovish than the primary data, right? And here's the other thing. If inflation signals over the next 6 months stay stagnant, let's say they don't continue to fall, but these numbers, like the non-farm payrolls, the wages, the revisions, unemployment, if those start to soften, now you have a situation where it's hard for the Fed to cut because of inflation is not getting lower, but now the economy's starting to slow down. That's not necessarily great for equities, right? You don't want to be long equities in an economy that's slowing down if the Fed is not there to support it. And again, it leads to this thing where the Fed could have to cut to try to support a faltering economy, as opposed to cutting in order to provide a soft landing of an economy that's humming along, right? And so again, you've got all these other factors. You've got the problems with Russia. You've got geopolitical issues with China. You've got, you know, the Red Sea is a problem, and that can affect inflation. We've got the problems in Gaza. We've got so many different things that could affect things. And, you know, I've said this before, is I feel like markets are somewhat priced to perfection. Again, if everything's at its all-time high, everything is kind of priced to perfection, but I just feel like we live in a very imperfect world. So it doesn't mean that things have to crash, but in my mind, it just says you have to be on guard for this rogue wave because it could come at any time.
So my first crypto cycle, like really being deeply indoctrinated, I was ready for what was being predicted a cycle before the COVID thing really gave it a boost. But that whole process was my first like front row seat, you know, understanding the narrative of what has happened in the past. And so I got to experience that, you know, not with a with shock and awe, more kind of a like, I'm ready for this and awe. But we had a catalyst for that. I remember going into, I was like, I just don't see how we're going to take out all-time highs and have this, you know, kind of crypto cycle euphoria. And then, you know, you had the lockdowns and stimmies and, you know, $5 trillion of Fed QE. Now, it hasn't been huge, but the Fed has been both raising rates and tapering. And you know, $5 trillion of liquidity takes time to cycle through the economy. So some of the things that we're seeing in all risk assets could still be somewhat contributed to outstanding liquidity. And I know everyone likes to make the argument that all this comes down to liquidity, but those indicators are starting to show liquidity is drying up, especially if you have stress in the commercial banking sector. They're not making loans. New money isn't being made. The Fed is tapering. There's no stimmies being handed out. Yet at the same time, we are now at you know, new all-time highs for Bitcoin. The narrative, or at least the excitement in that crypto world, especially in that altcoin world where, you know, they like to refer to themselves as degenerates, you have this excitement, like we're this is the next cycle. This is the next cycle. I mean, look what the price is doing. And you still feel like there's something similar going on in the equity markets, but it truly is different in that. Where is the liquidity coming from, and how is this thing going to push higher? Are you looking at this and saying this is? I know we talk about this, and this is what you say, that you know this is a little overbought, but it actually feels even riskier because of this excitement that, you know, this is the new round, and you know, stay poor is kind of the attitude all over again. But none of that liquidity, none of that catalyst. And even if the Fed cut 50 basis points, that's not enough to send Bitcoin to 150,000 and the S&P to 7,000.
Well, again, this is kind of where I'm coming from. I'm not saying that the prices can't continue to go higher. Of course they can. It's just that I think the odds skew or a pullback for many of the reasons you're suggesting. Again, you know, not only our market's price of perfection, but part of the reason they're priced at perfection is that the not the Fed, but the Treasury, through their various programs, have been providing a lot of liquidity, whether it's through the BTFP, whether it's through the reverse repo, whether it's the fact that they're issuing short-term bills rather than, you know, doing long-term bonds. There's a number of different things that the Treasury market has been doing that's provided extra liquidity to the system. Now, and a lot of that stuff is going to run out sometime in the next 6 months. So again, I feel like we've got this runway where liquidity could potentially stay plentiful through the election, but it could also dry up before that. And it's going to be pretty close. And so, you know, I definitely look at that because, again, at the end of the day, liquidity is the most important thing in the world, especially in a debt-based monetary system. There is nothing more important than the flow of capital and liquidity. And you know, what I kind of find interesting is with the all-time highs here is we do really kind of have the milkshake going on. And you pointed this out 2 or 3 weeks ago. And what it's here's what the milkshake is. The milkshake at its core, it's not about the dollar. The dollar is the catalyst for everything, but it's not just about buying the dollar. It's the fact that the dollar being stronger than other fiat causes certain things to happen in the market. And the things that have happened is it pulled capital into the United States. And that's part of why you see U.S. equities at their all-time highs. At the same time, the dollar has stayed strong versus other currencies. Now, sure, there's a few currencies here or there that are stronger than the dollar currently. But on average, the dollar is much stronger than any other currency. It's still higher than the highest it was in the COVID crisis. And that is despite everything they threw at it after the COVID crisis, right? All the balance sheet expansion, the helicopter money. And then not only that, but, you know, gold is now at its all-time high. So the milkshake theory basically said, this was back, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, in the years ahead, we're going to see the dollar rise versus foreign currencies. We're going to see the Dow rise, and we're going to see gold rise. I mean, those were the main three components. And that's what we've seen. The dollar was at its all-time high. It's still very high. Or not its all-time. It was at a 30-year high. It's still very high. Gold is at its all-time high, and the Dow is at its all-time high. And part of the reason this has happened is because global capital has flown into the dollar because our rates are higher than everywhere else. It doesn't just sit in dollars. It goes into U.S. assets, which is the Dow and these other big equities. And here's the other thing. Gold has gone up, but it's not because of U.S. people buying gold. There's been huge demand for gold from people elsewhere all over the world. And we can see that because gold ETFs and miner ETFs, they're losing capital. But yet the gold price is going higher. So the demand for gold is not coming from the U.S. It's coming from overseas. And the reason it's coming from overseas is because their currency is not the dollar. Again, people in Turkey are not buying gold because they're worried about the dollar. They're buying gold because they're worried about the lira. People in China are not buying gold because they're worried about the dollar. They're buying gold because the yuan loses value even faster than the dollar. And so, you know, what's always interesting to me is to see how this is, how do things look differently where you're at in the world, right? Again, if you're sitting here in the U.S. and your dollar doesn't go as far as it did 5 years ago, you're probably thinking, God, I don't know why Brett keeps talking about the strong dollar. But if you live in South Africa, or you live in China, or you live in Turkey, or you live in Egypt, which just devalued their currency, or if you live in Russia, you know, the dollar's gotten a lot stronger. And so you'd much rather, in your cash allocation, you'd be much better off holding dollars than holding your local currencies. And the same thing with equities. You're much better off overseas if you've been buying U.S. Equities opposed to buying local equities. And so I'm really interested to see what happens here with rates over the next 6 months. And I don't know what's going to happen with rates. I'm not playing the rates market because I don't know what's going to happen. I can make an argument for rates to go higher. I can make an argument for rates to go lower. But it is really interesting to see gold at its all-time high because people are recognizing fiat loses value, but it's not people in the dollar that are pushing that price higher. It's people overseas that are pushing that price higher.
Excellent. Well, for those who don't know, I operate a mortgage business in the U.S. in 14 states. The interest rate conversations is very important to me, and there hasn't been much to talk about other than the bond market getting massacred. So it's going to be interesting, and maybe something we discuss more on the show, if we start to see a shift in interest rates, because just like the equity market, the housing market has just been overrun with the bear narrative, and everyone who has been bearish has just been run over by the fact that home prices won't go anywhere. Maybe some of that's inventory. Some even the inventory support that's there doesn't matter if this unemployment or employment reality starts to shift. So we'll keep an eye on that. Brent, what I'd like to do is do a little bit of madness mentions, share some comments that we've gotten on Twitter and on YouTube, and kind of go into maybe some short responses to that. You know, you were just talking about gold and certainly dollar's role in influencing the price of gold and why some people are buying gold in other markets. But we did have an interesting question that says why, and you kind of answered it, but please maybe add some more light. Why are we seeing silver and particularly gold find new all-time highs, yet the miners are getting crushed?
Well, it's a very good question. It's a very good question. And I think part of it is perhaps that, you know, the miners just aren't buying it. Maybe gold is hitting its all-time high and it's going to fall back. Maybe the people that are in the equities are a little bit more bearish because they don't believe the rise in the bullion. It could be that they've just been burned for so long that they're finally giving up on the miners. But I think a lot of it also is the people that would normally 10 or 15 years ago that would have gone to the miners are now going to the Bitcoin, right? They're going to Bitcoin or they're going to the Bitcoin ETFs. I mean, the Bitcoin ETFs have seen massive inflows. Again, I think a lot of times, you know, Bitcoin for me is just like a pure play on global liquidity or expected global liquidity or the expected falling of real rates. If the market is expecting real rates to fall, then you would expect gold to go higher, Bitcoin to go higher, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, I think that's why gold is going higher. And I think that's why Bitcoin is going higher. But I think, you know, I don't necessarily think it's going to last. For the same reasons that I think equities could pull back, I think gold could easily pull back. I think Bitcoin could easily pull back. For us to get on this huge cycle where rates are falling and we push up another 15, 20, 30% in equities and we go to 100,000 on Bitcoin. For that to happen, you kind of need to have the global tsunami of liquidity again, right? Kind of like an after COVID. But how do you get that in an environment where inflation is already very high? Again, I think people have cause and effect here messed up. The reason that Powell would be cutting aggressively would be fighting deflationary pressures. And if deflationary pressures are in the economy, then that means there's a lack of liquidity in the economy. And if there's a lack of liquidity in the economy, then you're not still going to see gold at its all-time high, Bitcoin at its all-time high, and stocks at its all-time high. Again, you know, the Fed is largely a reactive agency. I think part of the reason they would like to start cutting is because of some of the stuff we talked about in the commercial real estate market and the banking system. They want to get to an easier stance so that when these problems start to show up, we don't have a crash, right? But if everything is at its all-time high, if everything is at its all-time high, why on earth would the Fed start cutting like crazy? Again, it's cause and effect. The reason the Fed would cut like crazy is if they're reacting to a lack of liquidity. Again, Fed cuts are intended to provide liquidity. But if liquidity is at its all-time high, why do you need Fed cuts again? And so I'm not saying the Fed won't cut. They've made it pretty clear that they want to. I just don't know that they're going to get to do it at the speed with which they want. And I don't know that they're going to do it at the speed with the market wants unless they are responding to pain. And if we're responding to pain, you don't have Bitcoin, gold, and stocks at all-time highs.
So one other thing I want to poke in there is, you know, we've had a run-up from more or less 15, 17,000, whatever it was, when Bitcoin touched bottom. Now, you know, we're teetering around all-time highs in the 69,000 range. I think many times people misunderstand your take on Bitcoin. You understand its mechanism, the role it can potentially play. You just don't think it's going to take over the world like everyone does, but you understand where it could fit into a portfolio. Is there, you know, looking back, I know you don't manage your portfolio with regret, but understanding this kind of liquidity beacon that Bitcoin offers, is there a small allocation that you would have wished that you've given to from the portfolio to Bitcoin? And if not, is it part of kind of just the risk management that you do, that you want to stay away from something that has that type of risk profile?
Well, so the first thing I'd say is a lot of my clients own Bitcoin, and I've helped them buy it. So I don't necessarily buy it in the portfolio that I specifically manage, but I've got a handful of clients that I have walked them through the steps, helped them do it. And, you know, some of them did buy over the last, some of them have owned it for a long time. Some of them have owned it for a little while. I think at one point, John, I think I said, listen, Bitcoin is potentially the most asymmetric trade in history. And so if you want to put 1% or 2% of your portfolio in it, or it, depending on your risk level, you are put 5% in, that's fine. I said Bitcoin could go to $1 million. It could go to zero. I don't think it's going to zero, but it could go down a lot, or it could go to $1 million. I don't know, but I don't manage it in my portfolio because it's not, to me, it's an asset that you buy and you hold on to, or you just play the short-term swings, right? And I've owned it, I've put on it from a short-term perspective, but as a strategic allocation piece, if people want to own it, I don't have any problem with that. What I have a problem with So I don't have a problem with Bitcoin itself. What I have a problem with is the Bitcoin maxis. When they say there is nothing that can possibly stop this train, there is nothing the government could ever do to just to derail it, then it's going to take over the world. It's going to become the global reserve currency, and it's the greatest thing ever. Those are the people that I have the problem with. So it's not Bitcoin per se. But to your point about the liquidity, you know, I do kind of feel like I missed out on the gusher of liquidity that we've had for the last year. You know, Howell, the guy that runs Cross Border Capital, he called it perfectly. And I was a little bit more skeptical. I understood his arguments, but I was a little bit more skeptical that we would get that flush of liquidity, but we got it. So, you know, we participated in it. But in hindsight, I would have obviously liked to participate in more than I did. And I think Bitcoin is the perfect way to participate in global liquidity.
Yeah, so there you go. You know, for a lot of people, getting exposure to some of those liquidity plays and doing so with an asymmetric opportunity, crypto still offers that, but it also comes with a lot of risk. That's why you get that asymmetric performance. Look, there's a few other things I want to highlight there from a comment standpoint. Angel Soul 3359 made a comment regarding the commercial loan defaults. We kind of, or at least the commercial banking sector overall, we've talked about. So we won't have to address that, but I appreciate the comment. Someone also asked about gold being at all-time highs. That was Matrix Mode 2. We talked plenty about gold here. One of the things I notice often, probably more so for you in the Twitter world, but we're starting to attract it now in the YouTube comments, is this, and we talked about this a ton in last year's episodes, this certainty aspect, and that inevitable isn't necessarily imminent.
I think certainty is a portfolio killer. You know, to me, there's nothing more dangerous than certainty. And I know there's a lot of people who then say, well, Brent, you're so certain about the dollar. Well, you know what? I have high conviction in the dollar, but I'm not certain about it. You know, the reason I'm long assets, and again, if you look at my portfolio, we're long a lot of stuff. And that is because fiat currency loses value over time, and over time, assets tend to go up and to the right. And if I am wrong and the dollar goes lower, then those assets that we own should go up and to the right. So I am not betting 100% everything that I'm 100% right. I know I can be wrong. But certainty, in whatever your strategy, here's the thing, the hardest thing in the world is to remain objective and to remain a critical eye on your portfolio when price is confirming your bias, right? So if you are a believer in Bitcoin, you are getting all the validation in the world right now. If you're a believer in gold, you are getting all the validation in the world right now. If you're an equity bull and think the perma bears are out of their minds, you are getting all the validation in the world right now. And so that is actually the time you need to be the most careful, or at least the most critical. So again, I think it's great to have conviction. It's horrible to have certainty. The only thing I am certain about right now, John, is my screen has been flashing that my battery is about to die. And so I'm pretty sure if I keep talking that I'm just going to disappear. It's going to be like The Sopranos. Boom. I'm going to be gone. But anyway, that's a, certainty is a killer, so get away from certainty.
Well, if you just flash and disappeared, it would be very much a Emperor Palpatine Star Wars maneuver. The last episode of Seinfeld was talking about the top button. You've got your top button undone, so that one's kind of covered as well. Look, there's two little quick comments that I'll add here before we wrap up. And if you disappear, that's your sign off to everybody. One comment was kind of funny. It said, "John, you need some sun." I chose a different lighting setup so people can actually see that sun is certainly not a problem for me here in Australia. And Brent usually has this more yellow style lighting. So it's funny that I would bring up that comment and we now have this contrast look. And then last, Brent, this would be great to get your take on and we'll wrap it up. There was a comment from a handle, it's TermoCat. And it says, "It's not a safe haven if you have to threaten to go to war with another country if they don't sell their commodities in U.S. dollars or stop holding their savings in U.S. banks, U.S. bonds." There is another term for that. Do you want to comment on that a little bit? Perhaps more the hint that, you know, the U.S. is a bully?
Well, I would just say I understand where he's coming from. It's a fair point. You know, if something is a true safe haven, then it shouldn't have to be enforced. And what I would say is you're welcome to that opinion. But I will bet you whatever you want to bet that if and when we get into a crisis, the U.S. dollar rising versus whatever currency you want to take, any other fiat currency. So, you know, if you want to be right or you want to make money, it's up to you. But, you know, you can talk about the world as you want it to be. You can talk about the world as it is. And as of right now, the dollar is still the safe haven fiat currency. Whether it's deserved or not, it's just the way it is.
All right, excellent. Well, we'll end it there. We appreciate everyone who stuck with us. Thanks for the comments. We'll start introducing more of those in future episodes. You can find Brent on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can find me at John Kutzmita. You can find the show on Twitter and on YouTube at Milkshakes Pod. And we look forward to finding all of you out there on either the comments on YouTube or on Twitter. We'll see you guys all real soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.